Welcome to the Workflow Show. I'm Merrill Davis, along with my cohort Nick Gold, and today we're talking with Mike Zamlinski over at Pro Video Tech.
Yes, Mike Zamlinski, good buddy of ours for many, many years. We're going to talk with him about his perspective on the industry. He's very plugged in, very savvy guy when it comes to production, post-production, technology, workflows, and all of the fun changes that are going on. Talk a little bit about his company, Pro Video Tech, which we've been working with for many years now, and working with Mike in various capacities for, gosh, probably like 7 years now, Mike? Something like that? Sound about right?
Getting close to 10. Yeah,
In that neighborhood. That makes me feel old. So Mike is a distributor and representative for a number of the software and hardware products that we work with here at Chesapeake Systems. So he's going to give us some insight on a few of the lines that he is basically the man for here in the United States. A lot of focus on archive, media asset management, and because of one of his lines and its, I think, applicability to this new Mac Pro that was just announced by Apple, we're going to talk a little bit about Thunderbolt and a lot of interesting, fun, new technology stuff as it relates to that. So let's start off with kind of you, Mike. You've been all over the place. When I first met you, I want to say you were were you the AJA rep for Chesapeake Systems back then?
Yep, I was handling AJA and Facilis and a couple other lines at the time, a now defunct company called ADTX. And a company called Silicon Color, which you guys may know got bought by Apple and turned into the product Color.
Which now is a little bunch of features in Final Cut Pro 10 and not a standalone product anymore.
Indeed. Yeah. That was a fantastic product, too. It's kind of a shame that it's gone.
Well, hey, I mean, at least you can say some of the technology. You know, it started off as like a $25,000 product. It turned into a $1,200-$1,300 product in Final Cut Studio 3, and now it's like little bitty pieces of it are in a $300 product. I mean, maybe that's something good.
The evolution of Apple software.
So you were working for AJA as one of their reps with another longtime friend of Chesapeake, John Ladle, for a while. What kind of interesting stuff? I mean, you were really involved with the AJA stuff, I think, through this entire era of kind of the, dare I say, commoditization of the nonlinear editing platform. But, you know, what was your perspective when you were dealing with all their stuff?
You know, the most interesting thing is I got to see the transition and work very heavily in the transition in the NLE space from standard def to high def. You know, now there's nobody really doing standard def anymore. I mean, you got a few people out there still straggling along, but for the most part, you can't buy an SDTV, you can't buy an SD camera. Everything you're doing is high def and has been for quite a few years. But back in, you know, 2004, 2005, that wasn't exactly the case. And people that were actually shooting HD had some significant workflow problems. There weren't nice intermediary codecs like ProRes back then. There were extremely expensive solutions to be able to do some of the work that we now kind of take for granted. So I think the biggest thing I saw and the greatest thing I learned in working with AJA is watching that entire transition happening, not only in post, but in broadcast.
Do you think we'll be saying the same thing about 4K 5 years from now? All the camera manufacturers and folks like that seem to want to be cramming 4K production and post down everyone's throats just to keep selling people things. Do you see that transition happening similarly to the SD to HD transition?
I think it's going to happen a little differently when we go up into the greater than SMPTE rasters, but the writing is on the wall right now. Last week was E3 and Sony announced the PlayStation 4 and said that it's going to handle 4K monitor output. The new Mac Pro is going to handle 4K monitor output. At CES, there were several 4K consumer-based monitors available. So now that you've got content delivery systems like Netflix going through something like a PS4 and into a consumer 4K monitor, I think we're going to leapfrog broadcast in general and hop up into this new world of ultra-high resolution. And I think it's going to hit kind of like a brick more than it did the smooth transition from SD to HD, where we had a defined timeline to go to digital broadcast and a defined timeline to go to HD broadcast.
You know, it's interesting. I remember when the SD to HD transition happened, there was a lot of these sort of two-up shots where it's on the left, you've got standard definition, and look at 1080p on the right. Now I saw something that has 1080p on the left, and it says, well, you know, that old HD, here's your old broken HD, here's the new 4K. So it's very interesting to see just how much clarity we continue to gain by jumping up to 4K. And of course, we're seeing 6K workflows on some of the high-end production stuff. Very interesting to see just where we'll land. I'm excited for a 4K television, quite frankly. I think that's going to open up a lot of doors, certainly for in-house color correction and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I know I'm waiting to buy a 4K TV when they come down in price and are basically close to what 1080p sets are today. And, you know, I have one of those big old cathode ray tubes.
Still?
1080i HD Sony sets. They're great monitors, but I'm not really going to buy a flat screen probably until, you know, I can get a 4K one for under $1,500, $2,000.
It's coming.
So, Mike, one of the things that you do as a distributor, you tend to forge these alliances with, I'll call them more maybe boutique software development companies that are doing interesting things, often at the forefront. One of them, and we'll talk about them in a moment, was an archive and backup software company that you actually turned me on to, I think well before you were even kind of officially their distributor in the U.S., but we'll talk about that in a moment. But a few of the areas of interest that you seem to be kind of homing in on over these last months relates to an area that Merrill and I evangelize pretty regularly, which is media asset management and this whole database-driven approach to management of media files and all of that. Let's start with one that you began repping and distributing here in the States relatively recently, and this is, I'm going to try to pronounce it how the Swedes do, because it's a Swedish company, Kantomo. Does that sound about right?
You're pretty close. You know, what's interesting is that it's a Swedish company, but the word's actually Spanish, so it's Kantomo.
What does it mean?
It's Spanish for dancing, so it kind of doesn't mean anything.
It's kind of like how they name cars or whatever. Like,
yeah, it's the 2013 Tercel of
right. Because you wouldn't call that, you know, with its English phrase. You know, and here's our ma'am dancing.
Dancing ma'am.
I've heard some pretty bad product names though in English, so I'll give them. At least it flows off the tongue.
We tend to call it Cantimo or something like that. And anyway, you know, this is a MAM platform that we had been aware of at Chesapeake for a few years and had heard positive things about. They kind of had a little bit of a, I'll call it, not totally nailed down distribution strategy in the States. And just so our listeners understand, there are often multiple tiers of middlemen in this industry, you know, Chesapeake and the systems integrators, value-added resellers being part of that. But there's also this next level up called the distributor, which is what Mike is. And distributors tend to be kind of the front man for a lot of products, especially when it's some of these more niche software companies. And, you know, Mike kind of becomes their guy in the United States, I think it's fair to say. And so when we found out that you were taking on the Kantomo and their portal product, we were really excited because this was a group of folks doing a nice MAM that we really wanted to engage with but didn't really have means to. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about your relationship with them and just talk a little bit about Portal, which is kind of their, I don't want to call it entry level because it's a pretty sophisticated system to be sure, but it's kind of their more widely marketed product versus their enterprise solutions.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the Kantomo Portal product, I first saw it at IBC back in 2012. I had heard of it quite a few times, and a lot of friends that helped me out in the European space that do similar products and had hip me to the product. So they said, hey, they've got a presentation at IBC. You should really go check this stuff out. And so I did. I went and saw a demonstration they were doing at an Apple event, and I was kind of blown away by what the feature set was and how clean the interface was and the fact that it was all web-based UI. So there was no thin client licensing or anything like that, and it was, you know, extremely accessible.
We could call it the IKEA of media asset management systems.
Does that mean you get Like, you have to look at a map and
but very, very
12
easy
hours walking around in a circle.
With a little outline of a guy.
Right,
the required tools. And no, then, but I should say it's funny because out of all the MAMs that we've ever dealt with, and we have a portfolio of them, it actually does have some of the best documentation from a user perspective, from an administrator perspective, or even a third party, like an integrator developer perspective. They have an SDK and set of APIs that you can use to extend its capabilities. And it actually is laid out as clearly as kind of an IKEA construction manual for that desk I'm sitting in front of or whatever.
Yeah. And the product itself is... The extensibility is one of the things that I also found to be really intriguing, is the fact that there was in the European market, there were already four different companies that had spun up their full business model around this Cantimo product and building little applications and add-ons, almost like this enterprise MAM iOS store, if you wanted to think of it that way, where their livelihood was based off of these commercial add-ons to a product, and they were only able to do that because the richness of the system itself and the hooks that they had into it and their ability to build these really great systems.
So like all MAMs, it's a web-based user interface. It's not a standalone application. You access the platform through your web browser. It's all HTML5, right? It supports a plethora of modern web browsers, so you're not locked into one app in order to get into the system, correct?
Yeah, it's absolutely correct. And it's even got some intelligence in it where if you have an older browser that's not HTML5 compliant, or even something like Firefox, which is modern but doesn't support HTML5 video, there are hooks within the system to go backwards, and we'll even load in things like Flash players and things like that for legacy systems. So you really don't have a platform you have to worry about. If you want to log into it on a Windows machine running IE8 right now and then walk across the hall and pop up Chrome on a Mac and then walk across the hall and pop up Firefox on a Windows box, your UI is going to be the same across all of those platforms, and your ability to manipulate the media, watch it, play it back is going to be identical.
So who's Portal for? Give a few examples of the types of environments and the types of kind of basic rundown of features. We don't want to get too in-depth, but just some of the things that make it appropriate for a few different use cases.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a pretty wide availability product. The interesting thing that, and kind of the standard that the guys tried to reach in developing the product, was to have something that was more universally acceptable, something that was more universally attainable, and then that had such a strong feature set on top of it for developers that when you needed those really specialized or specific feature sets, you could actually hire out developers to maybe help you do that for considerably less than buying some of the bigger systems. The entire team at Cantimo came from an enterprise asset management background. They were all developers for a product called Ardendo, which was then purchased by VizRT and then kind of turned into big company marketing mess, MAM. And they just didn't like the model of every customer having to be a brand new configuration and development effort on the part of the software, where they really didn't have any sort of cookie cutter feature set. Almost everything had to be very customized, and that made it very inaccessible to the majority of users that need asset management. And it's they built in a kind of a simplicity to the product where the goal of it was to be Google for your assets within your video workgroup. Whether that's corporate video, whether that's post-production, whether that's broadcast, it really doesn't matter. It's aimed at the center and being able to manipulate video assets and flow them through a workflow.
Now, in a post-production environment, it has integrations for the primary NLE platforms, Final Cut 7, Final Cut 10, Premiere Pro, and I believe you were speaking to those third-party modules. I believe there's a third-party module that allows you to bounce media assets between Portal and even Media Composer, correct?
Yeah, so right now we've got plugins that are just add-on development to the system that allow us to talk to Final Cut 7, Final Cut X, a full-blown panel for Adobe Premiere, and we were actually showing some preliminary stuff with Media Composer at NAB, so we hope to have that shipping pretty soon. It was still in the early phases when we were showing it.
Now, Mike, are these kinds of the add-ons that are additional, or this part of the way that we sell it? Is this part of the kit and caboodle?
Yeah, so it's a very extensible system in the way that you purchase things as well. You only purchase what you need. So you can get into the system relatively inexpensively compared to some of the other products on the market. And then you purchase what plugins and tools you need. And then over time, you can grow that with simple licensing. So if there are more functionality you need or more user licenses or anything like that, it's a simple license key. And voila, your system expands. And the core functionality of the system is based around the exact same application stack as the enterprise product, which means that if you start as a small company and you grow relatively quickly due to your advancement and business savvy, you can grow the exact same system into a full-blown multi-tier, multi-site enterprise asset MAM by just adding license keys.
And that gives you things like high availability on the database server, kind of a grid and scalability on its transcoding element, because one of the nice things about Portal is it has its own media encoding and transcoding engine built in. Those types of things are what you see in the enterprise version versus Portal.
Yep, correct. I mean, with the Portal standard system, we support up to 60 clients. We support up to 1 million assets in the system. But when you get beyond either of those two metrics, it's time to hop up to the enterprise product. We support one transcode engine, which could be a 16-core system. It really doesn't matter. It's just we only support one formal engine.
Gotcha, gotcha. Now, Portal is a platform that we build out for people. We put it on a server that they're hosting. You can either put it outside of your firewall in the so-called DMZ, or you can allow people to get into it via VPN access if they're outside of your immediate local area network. But it's something that we are building for our clients and they are hosting within their facilities. Let's talk about another MAM platform that you're representing these days, which is a very different model than that. And this is Media Silo. Again, another media asset management solution that we've had some kind of on-again, off-again with over the years. And we're very excited to hear that Pro Video Tech was going to be taking it on as a product that you guys help to market and distribute. This is different. Media Silo is media asset management in the cloud. Up with the Care Bears. what is that? What does that even mean? And why is that even useful? What is that, just cloud bandwagon-y stuff? Or does this actually serve some utility? Maybe you can compare and contrast with kind of a self-hosted MAM platform.
So, yeah, I mean, the big difference between, what I like to call a land-based MAM and a cloud-based MAM is a land-based MAM, generally speaking, has really fast access to localized resources and high-resolution media, but it doesn't do a good job of cost-effectively scaling across large geographies, and it's generally pretty cost-prohibitive to scale up for a lot of different users. So with a product like Media Silo, the opposite is true. It's relatively inexpensive to add 50 or 100 users within the system and relatively inexpensive to, have a presence worldwide with the system.
That's because it's in the cloud?
Yeah, they're using Amazon's S3 backend for all of their storage and Amazon AWS for all of their front end, which means that you've got a worldwide synchronization happening of all of your assets. So if you're in Baltimore and you decide to upload an asset into the system, you're going to hit East Coast servers in Manhattan. And as soon as that system hits that East Coast server, it's going to go against Amazon's backbone, which is faster than our heads would likely explode if we really knew what was going on there. And that media is automatically synced across the pond over to the China host. And now you've got access to that media locally on a fast connection.
So it's not probably touching your production SAN or storage with the high-res media directly, though. I know that because part of what you're paying for with Media Silo is the storage space in the cloud. It's common for people to be pushing proxy versions of media that they've maybe already generated to that, feeding some metadata along with the asset, and then using Media Silo a lot of the time for review and approval processes versus direct interaction with the editing platforms, that kind of thing?
Yeah, review and approve is a really very popular way to do it. The other place we've seen it be extremely popular is actually in scouting and doing location shoots to try to figure out what is usable, to collaborate with a production team that may be in, an office someplace else in the world. Casting is a very, very popular use case for it. So anybody that is sitting in a room in whatever major market that you're doing your casting in can immediately pop that little memory card out of that cheap little camera they've got on the tripod doing the casting calls and upload that while the next person starts to talk and is being recorded. And now the entire production team has access to see that, has access to put it through a review process if they want to, has access to make notes on it, organize it, categorize it, rate them, you know, 3 stars, 4 stars, 5 stars, that sort of thing. The other thing it gives you is the ability to have distributed VOD. Because the Media Silo system also has a very strong API, any media that you send into the system, you can allow, based on metadata rules, to flow into what we call a channel. And now you can create a web portal on your own website that you're not hosting all that footage. You're not storing it all on your web server. You're not paying for the bandwidth of it. It's all coming off of Media Silo's backend.
Kind of like how you can embed a YouTube video within your website, but it's still sitting on YouTube servers.
Exactly. And MTV uses this heavily. They actually use it for all of their red carpet footage for all of the different awards shows that they go to worldwide. There's a website that they have published for the press where all of that red carpet interview footage and press footage is immediately uploaded and available for high res for other people to use. It's watermarked internally by their system, and then any press junk can use it.
Mike, now would this be an appropriate configuration for, well, you know, I know they're very few and far between, but like a stock house? Say your core business is generating content to then resell to others, B-roll services or what have you.
Yeah, you know, and above and beyond that, you would be able to build your own pay portal for that. You would have to obviously have your own logic set up to build a paywall. The Media Silo product doesn't give you that paywall, but based on permissions and based on that portal you could build, it could automatically flow things in the Media Silo portal to say, okay, now give this user access because they've paid to the high-res content, or move this content from this project to this project because now it's licensed exclusively. They paid more to license exclusively for a term of 1 year, so no one else can buy it right now for the next year.
A follow-up question to that, Mike, is just like, what kind of hooks in the API, and is there as a robust scenario for a cloud-based service as there is on something that, as you're calling it, a LANMAM?
Well, you know, I would say the big difference between the two there is if you do have a speed difference in the speed that you have access to the system. So generally speaking, the cloud-based system is serving you proxy content for your review and approve, and then your high-res is a download as fast as the pipe you have available to you at that time. If you even choose to download the high res. Whereas with a land-based MAM, you're kind of always connected. And in theory, you have instant access or extremely high-speed access to the media that you've got. So I think that depending on your workflow, there's actually quite a bit of room for them to be products in concert to add an even more robust flow to the way that you deliver content to your customer.
Well, I know one of the things that we have talked about at Chesapeake is taking a system like Cantomo Portal and from that publishing into a more public-facing system like Media Silo, getting the pieces of software to communicate with one another kind of at an API level, and push a proxy and some relevant metadata from Media Silo to this cloud-hosted site that's a lower cost per user, maybe not quite as sophisticated, but again, to put your content in front of that wider range of folks, maybe your communications department or clients, folks who don't really necessarily need all of the nitty-gritty functions that something like Cantomo Portal provides. They really just need to be able to look at the stuff, maybe make some annotations and get some feedback to the producers, the post-production folks. I know that's something we've talked about. Obviously, if clients are interested in that kind of a system, they can talk to us about how we would work that integration and get the two products to speak to one another. But does that seem like kind of along the lines of what you guys are thinking, Mike?
Yeah, you know, at NAB this year, within the Media Silo booth, the overarching theme of questions was, I love it, how do I get it to talk to my land-based MAM?
And it, just so the listeners know, Mike is saying LAN, as in local area network, the one that services the folks on your network versus the public internet. I think you're saying that, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, you're saying lamb, like, you know, he like the meat.
I was thinking lamb chop.
Yeah.
You know, like from Sherry Lewis and Bram.
Yeah. Sock puppets galore.
Yeah, that's right. Love that's an added feature of any media asset management.
Free sock puppet with every MAM purchase.
That's right. And an annoying song that you can't forget, which I won't sing because it's probably already in your head.
This is the song.
That's the one.
Okay, sorry. Let's move on, shall we? We've been talking a lot about media asset management again. Listeners of our show will know that we often relate media asset management to this bigger issue, archive, where your media maybe goes to retire, as I like to say, or be put out to pasture.
It's the Boca Raton of your media.
Yeah. Complete with all of the...
Lots of mauve and buffets.
Exactly. You know.
Come back every Christmas and gets you a great sweater.
That's right. Yeah. It's $5 checks, baby.
So Archiware, you turned me on to many, many years ago, back when you were working at one of our peer companies, I'll call them, out of Detroit, where you're based. And Chesapeake had been looking for a vendor of software products that could do backup to tape or to spinning disk, archive to usually tape, data synchronization software to be able to kind of like clone a SAN or a file server or a drive to another one. So you kind of have that for disaster recovery backup. And we had gotten, this was years ago now, we had gotten really sick with Retrospect because it was just garbage. We had experimented with Brew and didn't have a ton of luck. It really wasn't as fleshed out as we were looking for. And I said, I'm going to ask my buddy Mike Zumlinski because he probably knows something. And I think you had a little forum at the time that you were maintaining for us integrators, and I had put that question out there. And you turned me on to this German software company called Archiware. Archiware. And you said, hey, check these guys' stuff out. They have a backup product. They have a sync product. They've got a archive to tape product. And we looked at it, and we really haven't looked back generally because we've deployed it now to many, many sites. Tell us about Archiware, these guys that we've been now working with and through you that you are distributing and representing in the United States. How does that relate to this conversation, and where do they fit in?
Well, for me, Archiware was one of those products that I kind of stumbled across. It was a friend of a friend that turned me on to them. It was a product that was – it's so utilitarian. It's something that every business – I don't care if you're doing rich media or you're doing print design or you're doing bookkeeping or everybody needs some sort of data management platform. They need some way to do disaster recovery. And Archiware did such a great job of it and did it at such a reasonable price point compared to a lot of the competition that I was just enamored immediately with it. It's possibly the most boring topic in the world to talk about backup and synchronization and archival, but it's a product that just does it extremely well. It does it simply. It's not difficult to get set up, and while it's not the cheapest thing in the world, it is a very cost-effective product against some of its competition.
So they've got four main products, and just to quickly review, they have backup, which either can back up your data either on a centralized server or across a variety of systems that you may have, either to data tape or to what we call virtual tape library, which is basically a hard drive-based storage system, but one that's essentially mimicking data tapes. And, another thing to throw out for our listeners, you may not realize this, but if you buy a tape library, tape robot, these are kind of interchangeable terms, but one of these tape drive systems for data tape, typically LTO at this point, and they just came out with LTO 6, which is like 2.5 terabytes per tape, you need software that can talk to the tape drives and manage that tape library. The libraries don't come with that, and the MAM products don't do that inherently. You need this, what I'll call middleware, to actually drive the robot, as I like to say, or communicate and write data to the tapes through the drives, read data back off of them, manage the sets of tapes. So they've got that backup. They've got Archive, which is a more of a, like, let's push this data in this form to a tape so we can kind of get it back. It's maybe finished projects, maybe it's kind of camera original footage, but we just want to make sure we got a copy on a robust medium. They've got the sync, which is kind of like just take this file server or SAN and sync it with this other one, right? And then finally, there's another interesting one, and I think this really ties into what you were saying, Mike, about just like everyone needs something for backup, but often people think it's too costly or too complicated. Can you just speak a little bit to Backup to Go? Backup to Go is, I believe, their latest product in their kind of main four-product catalog, and it just seems like everyone should have a copy in any company environment who either is or is not dealing with data backup for disaster recovery purposes, which an alarming few number of people actually have strategies for.
Yeah, and Backup to Go was kind of a new idea back when Prestor or P3, I guess at the time would be called. And what Backup to Go is really to talk to clients that generally don't have a backup option. I kind of like to think of it as Time Machine on steroids. It allows you a rule-based, network-based client backup. Backing up servers, obviously there's a lot of things you have to think about in data types and file types and timing windows and stuff, but it's generally easy because servers are always at the same place and they're always on. So I can ask a server at any given time to send me data, and it will, because if it's off, some bigger problem is happening. Laptops and workstations are not quite so easy to track down. You know, laptops are on multiple networks between wired and wireless. Workstations are on DHCP addresses, so they're changing every time they reboot. They could reboot in the middle of the day, they could reboot in the middle of the night. No one's stopping you from restarting the computer or closing the lid on it and walking away. So what Backup to Go provided was a way to reliably get data off of those computers in an unobtrusive way to the users. So oftentimes the users don't even know that they're being backed up, and then when they come to you and say, hey, I lost that really important file, you can smile at them and say, nope, you didn't. We have it.
So that's something that we can get someone on even a relatively inexpensive file server. I mean, even a little file server appliance, you know, just a little thing that lives on their Ethernet network or is bridged to their wireless network, and install the Backup to Go kind of client-side software on the main systems that they use in their environment. And you're just saying that kind of in the background, without people having to be aware of it, it's making sure that copies of the files are stored on that centralized server and not just on those internal drives and those various laptop or desktop machines that the actual users are in front of all day.
Yep, exactly.
And just a question on that. Of course, you can attenuate which time that kind of backup action takes place, right? So if you have an understanding of what the workplace requirements are, and between such and such a time, you know, we can't choke our throughput, you can set this for nighttime or weekend scenarios, correct?
Well, for Backup to Go, you can set which timing windows based on templates. So if you have groups of users that you know come in later in the day, or if you have, specifically if you have 300 users in your environment and they all come in at 9 a.m., well, you want to probably stagger the load, because otherwise 300 systems are going to hit the server all simultaneously and try to start backing up, and it's going to be a bad experience for everyone. So, you know, having we do have some rules where you can say, okay, only back up when this system is on wired Ethernet as opposed to wireless, or only back up when the system is plugged into the wall as opposed to on battery power, or only back up the system from the hours of X to Y. And the really important thing to note about Backup to Go is that the client system, the computer that is actually running, that the backup is coming from, is the system that's kicking off the job. So the server is actually just sitting there listening for clients to talk to it, as opposed to a traditional backup environment where the server is calling out to the clients and saying, okay, it's time to start our job now.
So this means there is an applet that's required on the front end on the client machine.
Yes. Yeah. You install the Prestor service on the client machine, and it's pretty much unobtrusive. It sits in the background and does nothing unless it needs to back up.
So the last thing I want to talk about with Archiware, again, let's talk about archive, because it's just a hugely overwhelming issue for all media organizations at this point, because they're not shooting to videotape. They don't have that little tape in the just sitting on the shelf of every shoot that they do. They're oftentimes shooting to expensive solid-state media or even onto hard drives directly and recycling those things. So almost from the get-go, things are just a file and often getting pushed to some kind of drive, but not really a long-term type of medium. And I can't reiterate enough just how many places we go into with the shelves or walls of FireWire drives that just make us groan and slap our foreheads with our hands and just say, you know, these things aren't going to spin back up if you leave them sitting here for 5 years. But they have this archive product. It's got a nice little user interface. You actually, again, kind of like Cantomo and some of these other platforms, you go in through your web browser to administrate the system. And you can kick off the archive jobs right through the Prestor archive interface. And it's a pretty straightforward system. It even has what I'll call like a little mini MAM built into it, where you can kind of add a few metadata values to your assets. But one of the things that we've done with the archive product, again, now called P5 Archive, as of the release of the Prestor 5, or now P5 that just came out a few weeks ago, is that we often integrate it with a media asset management system. So the archive software talks to the MAM directly, and users can kick off, send to archive, retrieve from archive operations without even having to go into the slightly more obtuse tape archive software user interface. They just do it, you know, through a button click in their MAM. That's happened already to integrate the P5 archive from Archiware with Cantomo Portal, correct?
Yeah. So one of our partners in Munich, Andre Aulick, great guy, he's developed a piece of middleware between the Cantomo product and the Archiware P5 product, where you can completely drive the Archiware P5 system from Cantomo. So sending content into archive, recovering it from archive, all happens right through your asset management system. But what's interesting about it is that we have the ability to send all of your metadata to the Archiware P5 system, and also, if you choose to, low-resolution preview movies or proxies. So if you ever choose to move away from Cantomo, your archive is not stuck in a state of not being easily searchable and finding the data that you need. Because if there's one thing I've learned about archive is that archive is forever, and it's a long-term data storage method, which means that you may go through several different systems in the lifetime of a single archive system when it comes to post-production. You may move from one NLE to another NLE. You may move from one MAM to another MAM. You may move from 14 different types of storages into 25 different other types of storages. But if your archive isn't searchable, it's pretty much useless.
So this is a way that people can have the archive system essentially be self-contained, not dependent on their choice of media asset manager. It keeps the metadata. It can even keep its own copy of the proxy that the MAM has probably generated. And you have that system. And maybe some users are navigating the archives through the archive software because it has that searchability at that point. It does have some of those metadata terms and the proxy movies that you can view through the web interface. But maybe another set of users is just going through the MAM interface because it's a little more streamlined and maybe end-user oriented.
Yep,
cool.
Exactly.
So, we've been talking a lot about software, but you deal with hardware as well. And I believe this next manufacturer, which is one that the Mac faithful have been aware of for, what, like 15, 20 years now, is Sonnet, who you are a rep for, which means you're kind of like suave pitch man for Sonnet. Is that a fair description?
Yeah, I mean, more or less, we work directly with Sonnet to help. They have a direct sales channel already, but we work with them to help show people what their product line is capable of and get a feel for all of the different products that they have, because it is quite a hefty list. I believe the Sonnet price book is in the 200 plus product.
My first exposure to these guys was probably in the mid 90s. And Sonnet was one of the couple of companies that, if I remember correctly, a person could go to for a processor upgrade for their Mac. Back when people even thought to do this crazy thing where you could like buy a G4 and get a faster G4 later on. You know, Sonnet was one of the manufacturers of those CPU upgrades, right?
Yeah, they were actually it was those guys in NewerTech. And yeah, actually there was a point at time where Sonnet was the number three consumer of PowerPC chips in the world behind Apple and IBM.
But there were only three. No, just kidding. Just kidding.
Oh, well, you know, Nintendo had them in Super Nintendo and GameCube.
Yeah, no, no, it was quite popular back in the day, but we don't typically do that as much anymore. So what areas has Sonnet gone into that people should be aware of? And, you know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, Thunderbolt.
Yeah, you know, Sonnet really has always been kind of a hardware engineering company. And when the processor stuff started to kind of go away, when it no longer made sense to be in that market, they really started focusing on inventive pieces of hardware that nobody else was really making. And if you look at their hardware, you know, their hardware line, by and large, the majority of the product they have does not have a competitor in the market space. They are the sole creator of a lot of very interesting host bus adapters for all sorts of different connectivity, be it eSATA, USB 3, FireWire 800, combo cards, media readers, things like that. But when Thunderbolt came out, they were one of the actually initial four that had access to it. Obviously, Promise had the first access to it before any other company did. The next three were AJA, Blackmagic, and Sonnet. So they've been in the Thunderbolt pool since day one. And now are making some really, really cool products to allow you to take, you know, existing PCIe cards and put them into Thunderbolt chassis, or my personal favorites, the XMac Mini server, which in the post-XServe era allows us to take a Mac Mini and turn it into a 1RU rack mount server with two PCIe cards.
So tell me how that works. Give an example, because that's an interesting one. We don't have a Mac server anymore. There are certain use cases where running a piece of Mac software on something that's a little more of a server form factor would be good, but the Mac Minis obviously don't have expansion card slots. What's that device do exactly? Because that sounds pretty cool.
So it essentially has a Thunderbolt out port on the back of it where we tap the Thunderbolt port on the Mac Mini, and we bring that into a two PCIe card bridge via Thunderbolt. So you can put two full PCIe cards off the back of the Mac Mini, and it's all enclosed into a single power supply. It moves all of your connections for the Mac Mini to the back plane, so it looks and feels very much like a small pizza box 1RU server with a couple of cards in it. But what this allows us to do is start to get back into the place where XServes were great. So if you're building, for example, a Tools on Air playout server, generally speaking, it's much preferable to have 1RU of space with your AJA Kona card in it and your storage adapter of choice and the software and the Mac Mini running than it is to have a Mac Pro that takes up 8RU half width, and you have to put a shelf in place and all of the things that come with that.
Well, and one of the other, and it's kind of along those lines, let's take a machine that has Thunderbolt but give you the ability to use a PCIe card. They have a line of enclosures that you throw one or even a few PCIe cards in, and it basically turns them into external boxes that you plug into your system with a Thunderbolt adapter, and it sits outside of your system instead of being a PCIe card that's living inside of it. One of our clients who I've referenced before in my recent blog post about the new Mac Pro is Butler Film, and what they do, what Dave Butler does, is he puts a red Rocket card in the Sonnet Thunderbolt enclosure. It's in a little box now, and he plugs it into his Retina MacBook Pro laptop, and he uses his red Rocket card to great effect on a laptop system to process red code footage. I mean, these types of things are kind of important now that we've got this Mac Pro that doesn't have PCIe cards anymore, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, you've now got the ability to do a nice, small, Mac-based, rack-based system for all of those specialty pieces of software that are Mac-only.
So what do you think about this Mac Pro? You've been in the Apple kind of creative world for a long time. Didn't you even kind of have like a contractor gig at Apple at one point, or does the ghost of Steve Jobs have to kill you if you mention that kind of stuff?
No, I actually used to work for Apple Higher Education doing field systems engineering and things like that. This is going back to, you know, 99, 2000.
Ancient history.
Yeah, back before OS X. Yeah. I was with Apple for the launch of a little product called OS X and a little product called Final Cut Pro. So it was some interesting times back then.
So you've seen the evolution of the desktop Mac workstation for many years now, the G3 days, the G4 days, the G5 days, obviously the Mac Pro days, which have been with us for a while. And for what, like 10 years, these desktop Macs have just been that big silver aluminum box. And something very different hit, what, a week or two ago at Worldwide Developer Conference. Apple has finally unveiled their new envisioning of a desktop professional workstation machine. And I heard a funny name for it. Some people will remember the Cube from Apple. Well, this new thing is this black cylinder, so we're going to call it the Tube.
That's funny. I kind of felt like it was like R2-D2 going through like his like goth phase.
Yeah, I see that. I see that. It kind of also looks like a trash can or something. But what do you think of it, Mike? I mean, what do you think about this direction? You've been supporting the Mac professional creative user for many years. I'd love to get your insight on where you think this is going to take us. Obviously, the Sonnet stuff really relates to it because it gives you a lot of capabilities through Thunderbolt that you're going to need probably if you've got a bunch of PCI cards sitting around or you want to continue to use them. But I'm curious just to garner your general thoughts about this. Good, bad, indifferent, wait and see.
I think it's actually pretty great. I've been waiting a while for something interesting again. I was a big fan of the Cube. I actually still have a Cube. It's sitting about 8 feet away from my desk right now.
We have one about 20 feet away from us right now.
Yes. I'm really interested to see if they can pull off the power that they're claiming and the form factor they're claiming, because it really is a game changer. There's a density there, just given the way that they're doing the thermal stuff, that's almost a whole new world when it comes to workstation class computers. And I think expandability is something people have talked about forever. And they're like, oh, it doesn't have, you know, removable video cards. I can't buy that. Or, oh, it doesn't have this or that. You know, most users don't use much more than what they need Thunderbolt for. I mean, I'm an extreme power user, and I am jumping for joy every time I open up my MacBook Pro Retina, which I can't change a damn thing on. But it is such a good machine right now that I have got no complaints whatsoever. And when it comes time in the future that I might need to upgrade it, you know what? I'll sell it and I'll buy whatever I need for the next sort of thing and hopefully get some of that money back. But I think the Mac Pro itself is something that, you know, three true Thunderbolt buses, Thunderbolt 2, 20 gigabit. I mean, we're talking about some significant expansion capabilities. It's just not in a form factor that most people are used to.
You know, and that's interesting. I mean, like, if there was anything that I read in sort of like the immediate response to WWDC, it was that most people wanted, you know, it was almost about cable management. It was like, where, you know, are they going to fit the same form factor? Is it going to look the same? I mean, like, I don't want to have six devices daisy chained about. I don't feel that way. I frankly feel like you'll get what you need. You'll probably have one to two devices, if that, for the basic user. But that seems to be one of the questions as to how I would imagine maybe even Sonnet or some other manufacturers might come up once we see more clear details about the Mac Pro, just exactly how this is all going to be managed. Are we going to have some sort of intermediary Thunderbolt device that allows us to sort of figure out how we want to connect it all and keep it maintained in an aesthetic manner and perhaps in a functional manner as well?
There is something telling that nobody's talking about the functionality of the system. They're just assuming it's going to work. And instead, they're talking about how they're going to have it look when it's sitting on their desk. I mean, that tells you the thing's going to sell like hotcakes.
Right.
Well,
yeah.
Sonnet has, I don't believe it's shipping yet, Mike. You can tell us when to expect it. But I seem to remember that there's a rack mount form factor PCIe Thunderbolt expansion chassis that Sonnet is going to be unveiling. So this is a way that you could have your PCI cards sitting on a rack somewhere or in a closet, run a longer Thunderbolt cable, and those are coming, folks. The optical Thunderbolt cables, which will work with the existing Thunderbolt systems just fine, are soon to hit. And so you'll be able to have something in a rack like, you know, 100, 200, whatever feet away.
What are you saying? We can have our PCIe and eat it too?
Ooh, I see what you did there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, when's that device coming, Mike? I seem to remember seeing that on the Sonnet website just the other day when I was kind of wondering about all of these things.
Yeah, so it's the Echo Express 3. And what that device is, it'll be late summer that'll actually be shipping. But that system is actually a three-slot PCIe card chassis that works over Thunderbolt. But it's actually not just rack mountable, it's also desktop mountable. So you can actually convert it from one form factor to the other. There's a custom case that it slides into for the rack, where it takes up about 2/3 of the rack, and then we actually give you 2 5.25-inch drive bays over on the side of that same rack. So if you wanted to have 8 2.5-inch drives there, or if you wanted to have a couple of tape drives, or you know, anything that you can fit there, a couple of Sonic QIOs, all being driven by this chassis, you could do that in the rack form.
I'm looking at it on the site now. It's really cute. It's got that stylized Sonnet S on the front of it. And I think these things are probably just harbingers of more interesting Thunderbolt peripherals that are aimed pretty explicitly at the pro user, and maybe this new class of Mac Pro user over the coming months, now that we know that this is the reality, right?
And I wonder out loud as well, because I certainly have this right now for HDMI extension, but is it even possible, or when will we see that sort of wireless Thunderbolt spec over, you know, 50 to 100 feet? And is that viable? But that might open it up in a lot of ways that would be really exciting.
And I will use this as a reminder for our listeners that we are, of course, a happy Sonnet reseller. So, you know, as you're evaluating what this peripheral infrastructure is going to look like for you moving forward, now that, again, we seem to be in the post-PCIe era, as Mac users are concerned, we can help you out with this. Again, we have some experience with it. There's change coming. We know this now. At least we know what it is. And it's nice to have both a highly knowledgeable and technical rep for a company like Sonnet that we can plumb the depths of in terms of his knowledge. So if customers have questions very specifically that even we can't help you with, Mike continues to be a great friend and resource for us and you, our listener, by extension. And I just want to thank you so much for coming on today, Mike. Now, you tend to take a direct hand sometimes when we're doing like a web demo of, say, Cantimo Portal. So if folks are interested in this platform, learning more about it, they'll probably have a chance to interact with you directly, right?
Yep, exactly. And if you guys need to, I also have a little, it's completely unrelated to the work we do from a sales and distributions perspective, but there's a blog at provideotech.org. There's just little notes and things that I find around the video community and interesting scripts and fun little things. And, you know, anybody that wants to check that out or contribute to some of the projects we've got going there, I'd welcome you to join in.
Again, that's ProVideoTech, ProVideoTech.org. Mike, thank you for coming on today, man. We appreciate it. You've been a longtime buddy of Chesapeake, and so we really want to extend a lot of thanks for you coming on and sharing your wisdom with us today.
Yep, I appreciate you guys having me.
As always, if you guys have any questions or comments, or you want to yell at us or tell us how great we are, you can reach out to us at Chesapeake Systems. And we welcome your questions and comments at workflowshow@chesa.com.
And again, Mike, thank you so much for being a guest today.
Absolutely. Thanks, guys.
Take care.
Bye-bye.